Hi, I'm Tyra G, your host of Frankly Speaking with Tyra G. Welcome again to our virtual global gathering of phenomenal women and those of you who love them. Yes, you, fearsome and generous, humble and honest, in pursuit of new possibilities and purpose. Every month we explore a new theme inspired by you. Yeah, I said you. We bravely walk into places where tradition has taught us there are some things we just don't talk about. But here, we live beyond the wreckage. Every week, our goal is to experience, educate, encourage, and empower one another. We share some aha moments and some stories that have been left in our pockets for too long. Every week, we start right where we are. This month, we enter our second year of production and proof that dreams really can come true. Frankly Speaking with Tyra G is one of my most favorite dreams. Thank you so much for being here with me. You're listening to Radio Fairfax, Fairfax, Virginia, on your TV, computer, or mobile device. And we are webcast worldwide on the internet at www.radiofairfax.org every Saturday evening at 8 p.m. Yes, I know, Saturday we have competing priorities. Sometimes they're called dates. But that's okay. You can find us in our archive collection on YouTube. Call Frankly Speaking with Tyra G. And those of you who like corresponding via email with me, keep it coming. I love connecting with you. That is Tyra at TyraGarlington.com. And thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you, Courtney Nero, for composing and performing our Frankly Speaking theme song and for being creative enough for naming it, I'm Listening. Our October theme is All Things Considered. We have four phenomenal guests that we are sharing considerations and choices that they have made to overcome, to evolve, to achieve, to excel in spite of rather than because of. They have been and will continue to be authentic and vulnerable as they bring their stories to you. They will share their heroes and their sheroes and the lessons learned and the dreams realized and the dreams not yet awakened. You know how I like to start each of our shows with a common thought space. I want you to consider this. It's resolution time. It doesn't matter if your emotional baggage is the result of childhood trauma or adult tragedy. The fact is that you have unresolved emotional issues that are weighing you down, causing you to feel less than and keeping you from reaching the height of happiness in your life. It is time to process it down into the fine, thin, unrecognizable, non-potent rubbish. Our emotional health is just as important as our physical health, but we don't give it nearly as much the same attention. How often do you think about your emotional health? How often do you feel a negative emotion? How often do bad memories from the past come to your mind? When you sense it or feel it, what do you do with it? Well, most of us deal with our negative emotion in two ways. We can consciously make the decision to either suppress or repress. Either way, we keep moving. We purposely stay in action to not deal with it. We choose to manage it by pushing it to the back of our mind, or we attempt to pretend it totally did not happen. Neither of those choices is healthy. Sometimes we suppress it because we don't know any other option. Given that most of our emotional baggage derives from events in our past, it's likely we spent years, maybe even decades, busy with making a life and caring for others instead of tending to our own emotional health. Well, guess what? It's resolution time. Right now, I dare and declare that for you, yes, you, listening to this right now, and for me, it's time to live emotionally whole, healed, and healthy. You spent years toiling to make a life, all the while setting your emotions aside. Remember all those late nights in the dorm studying for exams? Remember the first fever of your child that sent you into a panic? The jobs you've hated but suffered through? The car payments, the broken appliances, the ballet lessons, the elementary band recitals? I tip my hat to you for sitting through those and on and on. Well, you've done all that. Now it's time to do this. It's time to deal with all the baggage you've collected during that time. If not now, when? You have been listening to the healing and empowering words of my guest today, Miss Anita Washington. That is a quote from her first book entitled, 7 Simple Steps to Beat Emotional Baggage, How to Become Whole, Healed, Healthy, and Happy. After our break, you're going to hear the voice of wisdom. Anita will be joining our conversation. What I love about her is that she's a passionate professional who is committed to empowering others into their worthiness. Grab a snack. Hurry back. Stay close now.
This is Radio Fairfax, original non-commercial programming by Fairfax County Volunteers. Come join us and put on your own show. Learn how on the web at fcac.org/orientation.
You once, twice, 3 times a lady.
Hi, this is Trey Boucher with Morning Mix, where you'll hear us every Friday from 8 until 11, playing all of your favorite songs back from the 40s right on up to the present. We're going to play things that you remember, some new things that you're going to love, every Friday morning from 8 until 11 on Radio Fairfax.
Let's go down into the subway station where you hear the strangest things. Every Saturday at 4 o'clock on Night Train Memories, Sounds of the Cities. Trains in the night. Where are they going? Trains and music are joined together every time the night train pulls into another city for a few hours. I'm Squire, and the music is the Sounds of the Cities. Urban vocal groups from the 1950s through early 1960s with occasional new material. You might call it doo-wop, but it's a lot more than that. Every week, a new train to ride and new records to hear. Classics, favorites, obscurities, and some mega rarities. Night Train Memories, Sounds of the Cities, every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard about it, read about it. But have you ever seen a psychedelic circus? Those innocent fun games of the hallucination generation? Here you will meet the swingers, the hipsters, the beatniks, and the acid heads who live from pill party to pill party.
Find the Psychedelic Circus every Saturday from 10 until midnight. My name's Matthew Moore, hoping you'll join me for the Psychedelic Circus.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do yourself a favor. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
Hi, I'm Brett Michaels for the American Diabetes Association. Diabetes is a constant battle. Testing, treating, fighting to live a normal life. I know. I've had diabetes since I was 6 years old. A lot of people don't think it's deadly, but diabetes kills more Americans each year than breast cancer and AIDS combined. It's been called a silent epidemic, and without your help, it will keep getting worse. Please join me in the movement to stop diabetes. Share your passion and your story. Get involved in local events like the Tour to Cure or the Step Out Walk. Learn how you can better manage this disease or reduce your odds of developing it. And give what you can to help us spread the word and fund programs like the Diabetes Camps for Kids and research to find a cure. Join the movement at StopDiabetes.com. Help us fight a deadly disease that shortens and burdens the lives of millions of Americans. Together, we can stop diabetes.
And we are back. Hold on to your seats. Get ready to be impressed and blessed. Welcome, Miss Anita, back. This is the second time she's been in the studio.
Thank you, girl,
I've been waiting for this. I need to tell you this. Anita has a TV show called That Anita Live. So we kind of have bonded here at the studio. I've got radio, she's got TV, and we bump into one another and just enjoy our life's journey. So Anita, you already know, I ask each of my guests to pretend like they're a book in the human library and to introduce yourself like you're creating a preface to the book that would make us want to read you more.
I love how Tara invites you to be a guest on her show and then puts you to work.
Yes.
Anita Washington is an evolving essence. Anita Washington is an evolving essence of energy and space, seeking to exist within the pinnacle of contentment.
Oh, wow.
Education is her oxygen. Travel is her nourishment. Truth is her foundation, and her world is boundless.
Say that again. I am really impressed. I got education and travel. Okay, truth is somewhere in there.
Truth is her foundation.
Foundation. Okay.
She rises every day knowing that with her creator, all things she desires to be, do, and have are within her potential. Though patience is her toughest challenge, which with each opportunity she rises.
Hmm. Did you write that?
I had to be prepared.
She's impressing me. I'm loving it. I'm absolutely loving it. Well, I want you to know, she didn't tell you this. I got enthusiastic about having Anita come back because she has just published her second book. Now, I just read some words from one of the chapters in her first book. And her second book, I told her, I said, you know, your first book is like a little baby and your second book is like a grown-up. Mm-hmm. And I've read both of them, and I'm going to have her talk about, first of all, what motivated you to even begin to put on paper those things that were obviously in your spirit. I have to tell you, she's been totally authentic and vulnerable. So these are very honest books, and they're designed to help you. So what made you do this, Anita?
Because I got really frustrated and tired of watching women walk around suffering from the emotional baggage that they had suffered in their past.
And tell me, see, you didn't even mention this. How would you know about these women? What do you do?
Because I guess it's a gifting. That acceptance is something that I'm growing into because I try to always be very humble.
Yes.
But I can feel other people's energy. I can, whether we work together, whether we're in an elevator together for a couple of seconds, even if I just pass someone on the street, I can feel what season they're in their life. Uh-huh. And I can relate on some level, whether it's something that I've been through myself.
Okay.
Or if it, as a previously being a counselor, community agency and school counselor, whether it's something that I help one of my clients or my students get through.
Okay.
I can relate to it on some level.
And
so I decided to write the book.
Okay.
I'm going, and?
So I decided to write the book to put one, put it all in one place.
Okay.
But two, to share how I overcame my own emotional baggage.
Okay.
And then in doing my own work and my own research, to paint the picture in how childhood trauma can turn into adult dysfunctional behavior. Because we like to think that whether we're older, whether we're separated from it, or whether our accuser or abuser has passed away, that the pain and the suffering, the scars, have passed with that person, and that's not true. It comes out whether you have low self-esteem. It comes out, you know, if you're overly shy. Some people, they hide behind their children, saying, well, no, I want to put my children through everything. Okay, but you still have to have a life yourself.
Yes.
Because eventually your kids are going to grow up and go have lives of their own. What do you do?
Exactly. And not only that, Anita, they've been watching you. So you're modeling behavior.
Yeah.
And I have had to laugh at times when I'm doing something. I used to tease my mom on and check her on. I'm going like, I'm mom. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, what am I mm-hmm. doing? And I can laugh, but there are other things that we do that we've received some kind of way from our parents that, just as you said, are impacting how we're living our lives today. And so I want you to say the thesis again, and everybody remember this, because this is where I want you to park. As you listen, let this be the door through which you listen. There are things that happen to us as children or as adults that impact us, and we find pockets, drawers, behaviors that have become dysfunctional as a result. And so I told Anita, I said, oh my gosh, Anita, I read the book, and I was just like, I kept reading it over and over, and it resonated with me. And what I want to guarantee you is when you read it, it will resonate with you. Now, we have not bothered to tell you the name of the book.
The second book, yes.
The second book is where we want to park today. And the title is kind of interesting. What is it, Anita?
Family is not everything.
Okay, so there's a word in there that we don't expect when we talk about family. Am I right?
Correct, very much so.
Okay, so you've got some
Family is not everything. How to minimize their mess,
yes.
Maximize your happiness, and enjoy emotional baggage breakthroughs.
Why'd you write this book? I mean, what can they expect from this book if they saw it on Amazon or in the bookstore, and they picked it and go, interesting image. What could this mean? They read the table of contents. What was your intent?
For them to resolve their emotional baggage. Resolve their emotional baggage. Stop passing your pain forward and create the life you secretly crave to live.
And you know that this is happening with all of us because you said earlier, some of it happened to you.
Yes.
So why don't you walk us into the experience of writing the book, where you started, the emotionalism, the trauma. Why can't we can just start with one of the stories?
One of the first stories in the book that I share is where my father was a homicidal alcoholic. And by homicidal, I mean he tried to set the house on fire with me in the house 3 different times.
Expand on that.
And a lot of people, I know that kind of shocks the system, because father and fire and in the house really aren't supposed to go together.
Right.
But we have to start accepting reality and working with what we have so that we can work through it and move on with our lives in a healthy place. My father was an alcoholic. There was one time where I was on the sofa watching television, happened to be watching a show very very near and dear to me from the 70s called Good Time. And I was laying on the sofa and just began to smell this odd smell of smoke.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't cigarette smoke. It wasn't wood fire smoke. I couldn't really identify it until, I don't know, something happened, and it just, the memory of a previous experience from when I was a toddler popped into my head.
Okay.
And I realized that it was wood smoke. It was smoke from somebody trying to set the house on fire.
Okay.
Got up, ran to the back door, and yes, there he was, my father, standing with newspaper in his hand, kind of like kindling that he had set on fire, that was holding to the back of the house to try and burn it down with us in it. So I ran outside, adrenaline running, And it took me a while, you know, reading the book, but I did get the back spigot on the faucet on in the back of the house. And I didn't just wet the newspaper in the house, but I also soaked him from head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
And he just dropped the newspaper and walked out of the yard and back up the street. I wanted a fight. I really did. I wanted to just pound his face into the pavement.
Mm-hmm.
How could you? How possibly could you?
Mm-hmm.
With your family, whom you supposedly love, in the house, how could you try and set the house on fire with them in it?
And as I'm listening to you, there are two things mm-hmm. that come to mind. First of all, he probably wasn't in his normal state. You said he was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Was he inebriated at the time?
Yes, he was.
Okay. So even as you tell the story and I look at you, I sense the anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could you? Which takes me kind of to a definition, and I know you've run into this in your counseling with clients. What's the definition of a father?
I speak about that a little in my book also, because when we talk about one of the chapters in the back where I talk about fatherless daughters.
Yes.
When we look at what a father is, the expectations are that fathers are protectors and providers.
Yes.
Fathers are teachers. Fathers teach us how to ride bikes for the first time. They take us on our first dates. They teach us how men are supposed to treat us when we get older.
Yes.
My biological father was none of that.
Yes.
However, I did have uncles, coaches, my grandfather,
mm-hmm.
who were very prominent and significant in my life. When I think of how I want to be treated by a spouse,
mm-hmm.
those are the men that I think of. When I think of them, those are the loving feelings that come to the surface. Now, when you talk about my biological father, like you said, the anger comes to the surface.
And what I think is important for us to communicate and broadcast, I wrote in my book, the person who played the role of father in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so often, and some people aren't blessed. You were blessed. I was blessed because my father died too soon. He was those things you described, but he was gone. So how do you fill that great big hole? And research tells us that little girls look to their dad to understand what the expectation should be of a husband. And when he's not there for whatever reason, we're either blessed or not with surrogate fathers.
Yes.
And I know you talked about your grandfather, you talked about an uncle, mm-hmm. and the college friend, somebody stepped in at one point
yes.
during one of crisis.
Yes, he did.
And so what I think is strong, or maybe it was discernment, that you knew to go other places rather than just shut down.
Yes, yes.
How did that work?
Not to try and, just because somebody has the title, doesn't mean they have the qualifications to fill the position.
Right.
So I was blessed in where I spent a lot of, after I ran away for the first time, that story is also in the book. I was 5 years old the first time I ran away. For weekends and so forth, I was always taken out into the country.
Okay.
To be with my grandparents.
What state are you in?
South Carolina.
Okay.
And really, it's at a crossroads, because everybody on one side of the crossroads was kin to my mom, and everybody on the other side of the crossroads was kin to my dad. I spent all of my time on the maternal side, and my grandfather was very well-known and very respected in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever anybody pointed to me or tried to introduce me to somebody, they would say, that's Harvey's grandbaby.
Okay.
So,
okay.
And
that's the way they talk in the South. Everyone's connected, right?
That's Harvey Young. You know who Aunt that is, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Who your mama is.
Right.
That's right. That's the Southern tone. That's how we talk in the South, to relate people, to get to know who you are.
And I'm smiling again because I had told Anita that so many of the stories resonated with me and my grandfather in South Carolina. And my grandfather, just like my father, died way too soon, so I didn't know him. Really, he knew me, but I was really a baby. But my grandmother used to walk the neighborhood every day with me, all starched up, and the people on the porch, because there are always people on the porch, go, hey, Miss Fennell,
yes, right.
Who you got with you? Which one of your grandbabies, you know? Mm-hmm. And she was so proud, you know? And so there is a colorful fabric to our history. And I like to share that. I don't like to cover that up, you
right,
know?
Right,
because it was my grandmother that fixed grits for me. And I said, Grandmommy, I want some coffee. And so she'd put some pet milk in and something to make it look like it was brown. And I thought I had that. And she taught me how to be a storyteller. So those things I think we call on sometimes when we feel a little lonely, maybe.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Because those are the memories that remind you that you were loved.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you talk about, I'm jumping all around in your book. But first of all, Anita's book is a selection of stories, but it's also a selection of activities and exercises and evaluations the reader can use to minister to his or her own spirit. And
because I give you the trauma stories you can relate to and the steps to help you heal.
Absolutely. And it's done in a very orderly fashion. But I want to stay on the stories. Mm-hmm. I want to stay on the stories. I had an image of a little girl who didn't eat breakfast at home. Mm. And go ahead.
I was not a child that would eat cereal, cold cereal, whether it was cornflakes or Fruit Loops or my grandmother's choice favorite happened to be Cheerios, and we all know that Cheerios has a very low content of sugar, which is something that young children love.
Right.
And I would sit for hours and hours and hours, and finally when my grandfather would come in and dismiss me because he didn't want to look at my long face while he was trying to eat his lunch, I would run from my grandmother's house down, I don't know, maybe 400 or 500 yards down to my great aunt's house.
Okay.
And I'd run into the house hollering, "Hey, Pearline, hey, Pearline, you had breakfast?" Knowing that breakfast hours in the South had long been over.
Right.
It could be high humidity, 95, 100 degrees outside, didn't matter. But whenever I ran into that house and asked Aunt Pearline, had she had breakfast? She said, "Come on in here, let's see what we got for this baby to eat. Marilyn didn't fix this. She didn't feed my baby this morning." I say, "No, ma'am. I'm telling that big bold face to lie." I'm sure in the back of the church, they probably had a good laugh about me and my eating habits. But and then Pearline would always grits, eggs, ham, sausage.
And you know what I'm, maybe you don't know what I'm doing, but I have a strategy. There are things in Anita's book that have to do with family that for a while was very disappointing. But before I walked into the relationship with her mother that was very disappointing, I wanted the audience to understand that you had a whole hunk of good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, you were probably a spoiled little something. Running from house to house, you know, I need this or I need that, and they believed you.
Yeah, because of course my grandmother would be one to always try and give me water, and I didn't want water, but I knew, you know, two houses down and through the path, I could go down to Miss Thelma's house and get all the red Kool-Aid that I wanted. Wouldn't nobody drinking water?
So you talk about, I wanted the balance. This is good stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
South Carolina's good memories. South Carolina's you drawn for strength.
Mm-hmm.
Critical problem solving and all stuff they taught you.
Yes.
Okay. Now let's same time frame. Let's think. Go home.
Okay.
And I want you to describe your family dynamics, your mom, your brother, and all that, and what it was doing to you that made what we just talked about so important. That made what we just talked about, maybe your survival button.
It made it important because I didn't get the, I guess, love, support, and guidance from a nuclear, an immediate family that someone is supposed to get. I didn't get that. What I got was, of course, as you heard it earlier in the interview, my father was a homicidal alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was very abusive. And my mom, I said, was neglectful. She was neglectful from the standpoint that she would say things, well, that's just how your brother is. Or when I tried to lament to her about the things that he was doing, she would turn her back to me and just start singing as if I wasn't even standing there. So for those things to be so detrimental and so traumatic, I did have the opposite side of the coin whenever I went to either grandparent house.
And what we've actually uncovered together is your biological father did not fit the definition of what we were raised to believe a father is.
Right.
I'm hearing you say my mother didn't either.
Right.
Now, I have spent a lot of time thinking about, as I read the book,
mm-hmm.
what we need from our moms, and when they don't deliver, what we do with that, you know.
Right. Some people sit in it, and that becomes their emotional baggage. However, for me, like you said, I was blessed. Mm-hmm. And where I had the seven great aunts,
mm-hmm.
I had a very strong-minded godmother,
mm-hmm.
and I had those two grandmothers. So I wasn't hurting for maternal guidance or love. And some people say that, well, only your biological mother can give you. That's only if you sit and fester and let that sore
mm-hmm.
never heal.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to, even the Bible says, when my mother and father forsake me, the Lord will hold me close.
And I'm also hearing you say, love is love.
Yes.
Love is love. Mm-hmm. And I learned that as I was growing up. I'm an only child. I was an orphan. And I found out I wasn't lacking. There were people who held me close and dried my tears. Mm-hmm. But, okay, so now she's writing this book, Family is Not Everything. Now, you've gotten a really good picture about extended family, and it was everything. Now we're going back home to mom and brother and mm-hmm. father. We kind of have a glimpse of daddy and how he kept you from not being daddy's little girl.
Mm-hmm.
We have a glimpse of mother. We don't hear or see in the book so much why mother's neglectful or why she cannot
right.
respond
mm-hmm.
and why she's so overly protective of
her sons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want us to talk a little bit more about that, and I want us to talk about sibling abuse, of which there is no legal definition.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So can you take us into the house?
Well, I guess I could, let's see where to start. I could start with the brother. As a child, I saw him abuse his girlfriends and then his wife.
Okay.
So that's really where, in the chapter where I talk about being hit but not the target.
Yes.
Because even though you're not the domestic violence victim, mm-hmm. per the term, you do have some residual damage and emotional baggage that comes from that because of the violence that you watch.
Right.
That brother then turned to be abusive towards me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what would happen out in the street, but once he came back into the house, dragging me off the sofa, pounding my head into the hardwood, the only way that I could get away from him was to leave the house, and this would be 2-3 o'clock in the morning.
I think we need to say how much older your brother was than you.
10 years.
Which makes a viable difference,
yes.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about leaving the home. You chose what you didn't see as danger, but you chose external danger to danger in your house.
Because, right, the only way that I felt that I could get away from him was to leave the house. So running out of the house in the middle of the night and sleeping out in the street until I knew the next morning when my mom would be home from work. And 9 times out of 10, he would be up and gone from the home.
So I took that first running away with you. I was with you, and I'm going like, what? She did what? Talk about, if you can, I know you can remember because you couldn't have written about it if you didn't. What was that like for you? He has beat you, and you've run. Now talk about that running away experience and where you wound up.
And the running experience was very physically trying. And what I can look back now and see is how the emotions and the physical are attached.
Okay.
Because in what I felt with the burning in my throat and in my chest, and the fear in whether or not somebody would, one, catch me and drag me back to the house, thinking that he was being supportive or protective,
mm-hmm.
and I just wasn't, you know, how they think children are supposed to be mm-hmm. seen and not heard.
Right.
Or if I would just be kidnapped by some stranger and not know where I would end up. I ended up sleeping most of the time at a school that was near the house that had a heating grate in the back by the cafeteria. And I would go back there, and that's where I would spend the night. And then when the sun rose the next morning, I could kind of tell what time it was, I'd return to the house knowing that my mom was there and he was gone.
And interestingly enough, knowing your mom would be there, there was some residue of expectation that your mother was going to protect you, knowing she would be in the house?
Well, not necessarily. Well, that she would, she wouldn't let it continue.
Okay.
She would stop the fight from happening.
Okay. And...
But to be the parent that stepped in to say, this isn't how you're going to behave and you have no right to hit your sister, that never happened.
I think this would be a good place to talk about what legal, psychological things are not in place to address sibling abuse. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The belief right now is that, there is no statute or legal issue that says sibling abuse is a crime.
Okay.
However, as a basic human being, I felt I had rights.
Yes.
So if it wasn't right for me to hit, I couldn't take that behavior to school. I couldn't take that behavior to church.
Right.
So why was it right for that behavior to happen to me in the home? Parents, a lot of the time, say it's difficult for them to tell the difference between sibling rivalry mm-hmm. and sibling abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult for me to accept that.
Okay.
Because if one child always wins, there is a problem. If one child is always not participating, but yelling, stop hitting me, mm-hmm. or withdrawing from mm-hmm. the other child, these are all keys and cues that the parents can look at and say, hey, this isn't sibling rivalry. Because they're not competing. One's always winning. It's not an equal push back and forth between the two.
So, I'm an observer, obviously, to the situation. What we're discovering now in the 21st century is some of the mores that we had in the 50s and the 60s have facilitated or enabled guilt, shame, avoidance behaviors of those of us who were little at those times and now brought those anxieties, those fears with us to adulthood and maybe not even knowing that we have that baggage until you sit down with yourself and take a look. And I have to say this book is fantastic. And we'll spend some time a little bit later on some of the activities that force you to look in a mirror, that force you to write something, to create a list of things based on something that happened. And I tried to do one based on a quote from Jim Rohn, you know, like, at any time, you're a combination of the five people that you spend the most time with. I had fun with that one. Okay? Yeah. Anyway, you at home ought to try that. It's not as easy and as fun as it sounds, really, because you have to take a look at yourself while you're looking at those people. But getting back to the family, okay, you said education is your nutrition. Or did I? Yeah. And that's been your value your whole life.
Yes.
In your biological family, were they in concert with you? Education, is that important?
Education was something that was very important to my mom. And you mean my immediate family, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about, yeah.
Uh-huh. Education was something that was very important to my mother. My father was a teacher. And I'm Catholic. Everybody knows that Catholics are very heavy on education.
Right.
So, yes, from very primary years, education was something that was pushed and told and taught that this is the beacon of light.
And there was a nuance. You know, I'm teacher turned principal turned counselor, all that stuff mm-hmm. as well. But you said, it was a math class. I don't know whether it was algebra. I don't know what it was. But the teacher that you were assigned to.
Algebra 1, yes.
Algebra 1, mm-hmm. yeah. And you didn't do well because, you know, teaching styles and learning styles often conflict.
That's a nice way of putting it. Well, there were two African-American students in the class. She sat us in the back of the class on the last row. She never even called my name for the row. She totally ignored us the entire year. I ended up failing Algebra 1 ninth grade. And for by the grace of God, the counselor that I had my sophomore year, uh-huh. because magically, somehow, the computer did the scheduling and put me right back in the same class with the same teacher. My guidance counselor at the time, for my sophomore year, pulled me out of that class the first week of school and put me into a class with a teacher she knew was going to, one, regard me as human, two, teach me algebra, and three, not allow me to get away with anything as a high school sophomore.
Which we try to do.
Yes.
But what's nice about that story for me is the difference a mentor slash teacher can make.
Yes.
Because the first circumstance could have turned you totally away from the fact that you have advanced degrees in math. Hello?
I do.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Do you all out there, are you listening? So let me just broaden that whole thing in the conversation and say, you may not even understand, you listeners, that you are a mentor to somebody who is watching you, whose life you are touching, maybe formally or informally. So be aware of who you are and try and wear your best self when you are around other people. That's just a word to the wise is sufficient. That's what my dad used to say before he punished me. A word to the wise is sufficient. But anyway, I don't want to get us stuck on that because there's so many other things, okay? Mm-hmm. All right, so let's take a brief break, and we will be right back. Maybe we won't. This is Radio Fairfax, Fairfax, Virginia. We are back. Yes, we are back. And I'd like for you to think about this book as you have divided it up. And I want you to talk about intent, but there is a portion I want you to start with that has to do with a relationship, a dating relationship. Okay. And you were what we call an adult, and how later on in the book you actually understand some of the things you brought from your childhood that made dealing with this particular relationship difficult.
Okay.
All right.
I was dating this gentleman. He was in the military, and we had taken a vacation together.
Mm-hmm.
There were some things that happened on the vacation that I did not feel comfortable.
Okay.
We were walking along one afternoon, and he said to me, you know, I could really kidnap you and hold you in an abandoned building and nobody would know. At that point, I kind of started walking a little faster. We were on a cruise, got back to the ship,
mm-hmm.
and began to distance myself from that point forward.
Okay.
Instead of taking a phone call every day, maybe a phone call every 2 days, every 3 days, just slowly trying to fade to black to end this, mm-hmm. and move on. Because one of the things that I took from my past is I didn't communicate my feelings. I acted them out.
Now, see, this is what I want us to park on.
Mm-hmm.
That is based on your circumstances.
Right.
You adjusted your behavior and expectations in a way that made you less than able to deal with a situation that could have helped you extract or set boundaries or respond. Is that correct?
Respond faster, yes.
Okay, okay, yeah. Okay. So, so you want to break up with him. And he doesn't want to break up with you. What do you do? What does he do?
He, on the telephone, there was one day where I did not take his calls all day. While out at work, early evening, I did not take his calls. He would call repeatedly, as in not leaving a message, but just calling, hanging up, calling, hanging up, calling, hanging up. And I answered the phone that evening, asking him, why do you continue to call like this? What do you want?
Mm-hmm.
This is over. Leave me alone, was the gist of the conversation.
Now, fast forward to how that impacted your professional and personal life. How did you wind up in jail?
He called the police and told them that I was going to kill myself. Now, mind you, I hadn't spoken to him. That was the only conversation we'd had all day, and he was 5 states away.
Well, now, here's the interesting thing. What was the response of the police?
They showed up, searched my home. It was really a big ordeal because they blocked off the street. There was, I want to say, at least 10, 15 cops outside of the house. They had evacuated my neighbors. they took me down to the, as you call it, precinct, and I sat there for hours before somebody came in and said anything to me. She asked me questions to validate his story. Why did you tell him you were going to kill yourself? Ma'am, I did not tell him that. He says that you're upset because he won't marry you. I don't know where he's getting that from. I haven't brought that conversation up. I'm not even looking at magazines. Later on, I did find out where those thoughts of his came from, but it had nothing to do with me. That was, I guess, my Jonah in the whale experience, because there were 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever I am, I speak my truth. So I happened to come across some people that I did have some very heart-to-heart conversations with in the situations that they were going through at the time. Then afterwards, I had to think about what I was going to do. After I was released, 3 days, and I was kept for so long because it was a weekend. They picked me up on a Friday, which means nothing happened until...
Right, court.
I'd seen other people go through the process. Different for me, being on the other side. Even going in to visit people that I knew had been in. It showed me, it made clear for me who my friends really were.
And two things. I know we have enough for about 4 shows, but time is going. I really want us to highlight 2 things that grew, that you grew into as a result of this. And what I picked up, and this is just me, through my lens on that chapter, or those 2 chapters, was how you're seeing yourself impacts how you respond to critical situations. And I had a sense at that point that you were not in touch with the woman you were created to be, the woman you are now. There was more fear than there was faith.
Yes.
That's what I was reading, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I was very angry with him, and I was very angry with your history, and I could relate to the arrest scenario, the whole like you crazy scenario. I could relate to all that. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is, one, we are never alone. So you did find people to have a healthy conversation with. That's the first thing. But second, you survived. You survived the ordeal, even though I had a sense you felt powerless.
I did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the message I want our audience to hear is, yeah, okay, there are times you will feel powerless, but this book has activities, and I want to, because of our time, maybe jump to some of those in a little bit, but want you to understand there are things you can start to do as soon as this show is over to take a look at who you are, understand whose you are, believe that you are not alone, and I'm going to let Anita talk about what you think the most significant teachings are out of your book that would help someone do that. Now, I know, where do I have my list? I have my list. How to commit to change. It's important that you have to make a decision to change. So you can talk about that. And then the thing that I think is so important, you alluded to it, is letting go of people in your life.
Yes.
That are not really adding anything and maybe taking away. So can you talk about change, people, relationships, and well, let's just start there.
The activity that Tyra's referring to right there, it's called disposing of distractions.
Yes.
And once you go through your life and you figure out what your limiting beliefs are, what your blocks are, what are some of the experiences are that have led you to have the dysfunctional adult behavior that you have, you can sit down with the activity from the book and you list out everybody that you spend time with, everyone in your telephone, the people that you talk to on social media, and you will be forced to put them in a priority. mm-hmm. as to how they add value to your life, not by title, not by name, not by perceived importance. Like, you might want to put your boss high on the list. However, mm-hmm. if that person isn't adding anything to your life, then they don't go high.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go within one of the inner circles in the activity. And then the tough part is making that decision, like she said, because once you have that list and you see who the people are that are adding value to your life and who the people are that are toxic to your life, you have to make the decision to let go of those that are not adding value to you.
And what I did the exercise, and I had to recognize at some point along my life that included significant other, job, church, relatives, and those are very hard lessons. And one of the things you're going to love as you read her book is the language. She breathes life into her words. For instance, she says, fight for healthy, the voice of reason, stuck at the window, uncovering the source. And the thing that I loved, of course, because it resonates with me and I tell it to you all the time, Anita's book makes it clear that all of this is about a process. It is not an event. And if you were to kind of spend a couple of minutes, your message, what you hope this book will do in other people's lives, can you do that now?
I would hope that it would free them. As I said in the title, minimize their mess. As in, it doesn't matter who it is, mom, dad, siblings, mm-hmm. church members, co-workers. Minimize mm-hmm. the space in your life that their mess takes up and how it affects you. And then maximize your happiness. Go through the activities, learn the affirmations, take the techniques, actually complete them to get a clear view of yourself. And once you see what your core is and who you really are as a person, and then all of the gunk, the slime, the baggage that is put on top of that, you can free yourself from those limiting beliefs, from all that baggage that you're carrying, and actually live life as an authentic person, true to your own spirit and character.
And all of those good words, the one I want you to carry home with you is affirmation. That's a positive word. Put it in your pocket. Put it on a 3x5 card. Put your list of affirmations on there. And I'll give you my list for you at the end of the story. But want to pull a quote from the book that Anita uses and I think is extremely appropriate. It's from Katy Perry. And it says, it doesn't matter where you start, but what you grow into. And so I think what we're saying is, no matter how good it is in our lives, mm-hmm. it can be better.
Yes.
All we have to do is take a look. And our life wants the best for us, even if we don't know it. I always like to leave a little something in your spiritual doggy bag for that moment when you're tired and saying, I'm through with this. I don't want to do this anymore. Or what kind of day is this? Are you just going, what? Well, just add this to your doggy bag. After thinking through your past years and taking ownership of your experiences, you must decide on movement and in what direction and at what cost. When you regress, stay stuck or move forward, what will you do? Regressing and staying stuck cost a lot more in time, effort, and happiness than moving forward. You'd be amazed, and maybe not, at the amount or the number of people that stay in relationships and jobs that stifle their growth and development. I've seen women stay in relationships that were physically abusive for decades. I've seen women stay in relationships that were financially abusive for years. I know people who have sat on dysfunctional jobs feeling they were just four clover lucky away to have the job that they want. Gratitude is the fruit of the Spirit. It's necessary for growth. God doesn't want us getting too big for our britches. I get it. But he also didn't mean for you to remain the 18-year-old forever. I bet you've got dreams. I bet if you're wired $1 million, you could have it spent in less than 30 days. What are you going to do after the dream? No, not the one for your kids or your family, but the one for you. Are you ready to make the commitment to move forward? Again, a wonderful quote from Anita's book. And I'm going to say the name again. Family is not everything. How to minimize their mess, maximize your happiness, and enjoy emotional baggage breakthroughs. I'm going to ask Anita to speak into the mic and tell you how, if you want to continue the conversation, to reach her.
You can reach me at my website, That Anita Live, or on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at the same handle, That Anita Live.
And I want you to hear me when I say that. It took a long time for me to look in the mirror, linger, and feel right about who was looking back. I have faced the kinds of things we talked about up close and personal for many years, but I had demons. I had demons inside of me. They were related to shame and guilt and confrontation, avoidance. It took a while. And I was afraid in my time of despair to ask for help. I thought people would reject me or wouldn't like me. But at the very moment I decided to give up, God reached down to me and said, "My grace is sufficient. I am not going to let you go." It was then he began to tell me, "Look, when you're confused, feeling betrayed or abused, check your label. You are not a markdown. You are a designer's original. You are fearfully and wonderfully made. Please trust in who you are. You are awesome. You are worthy." This is Tyra G. Your seat at the table is guaranteed. I so look forward to next time. Be encouraged. Bye now.